You always look for a smiling face to connect with when you're doing this kind of thing. And I see Richard smiling at me, which makes me feel good. My name's... And Matt's smiling. My name's Peter. I'm a retired teacher and counselor. I have three beautiful grown-up kids and an amazing wife who stood by me for 35 years. And I've been a member of this church. Yeah, she needs a hand for sure. I'll be talking a little bit about immature adulthood, and it pertains to Peter more than it does to Pam. But I've been with the River Church since its inception. It's a privilege to be here this morning to be sharing with you. Thank you for listening. There's some slides to track with. There's some visual images. Kids, get lots of paper and lots of coloring stuff and just go for it and feel free to drift off and don't pay attention, because some of the stuff I'm talking to adults, hopefully some of the stuff you can track with a little bit and get something out of it. I hope for all of you that there's something for you. There's something for your spirit. Jesus has something for you this morning from the worship, from the communion, and maybe from a word that I have to say to you. There it is. There's the first slide. So I've taken some photographs over the years. I thought of comfort zone a little bit this morning when Darcy and Ann and Laura and Jim looked at me and said, gee, we need a speaker for August. You didn't do it last year. What about this year? I was reluctant. I'm used to having a captive audience that has to be there. For students, they have to come to class. Speaking at Naomi's graduation, everybody had to be there, and I was speaking. So this is the first time we've actually come voluntarily to hear what I have to say, and it's quite intimidating, I must say. So this is a bit out of my comfort zone. My youngest son, Nathan, just got married August 9th at the cabin, and it was a wonderful family time and a celebration. He's married a beautiful woman named Valerie. It was romantic, and our hearts were together for a bit that day and Saturday in August. Nathan said to me 3 years ago, Dad, I have to get out of my comfort zone. And he literally used that word, comfort zone. And he said, I need to go where I'm going to sink or swim. And he's a photographer, and he wanted to develop his craft as a photographer. And he moved to Montreal for the reason of being pushed, moving away from safety, moving away from predictability to a place where he just had to engage, had to sink or swim. He was out of his comfort zone. Darcy talked about getting up in the trees and being in the top of the tree in a storm and the trees waving and the wind racing by and the rain in your face. And sometimes that's how we have to embrace life. Sometimes that's where God wants us to be. And I thought of these trees here, and I thought, I want to be up in that tree. I want to be in the storm. I want to have the wind blowing by me. But the irony of the comfort zone is that sometimes we need to move out of comfort zone, and sometimes we need to move into the comfort zone. Sometimes we need to move away from the rush and the bother and the stress and conflict, sit under a tree, embrace its shade, and let God speak to our hearts. So there's two sides to comfort zone. My story, I'm going to share with you today a bit of my story, a bit of what I've been learning recently. I hope there's something for you. I'd like to share a bit of attachment theory. I'd like to share some of my history and where I'm at now in my life. I don't feel like I have a spectacular story. I don't feel like this is going to be something where you're amazed at some sort of conversion experience or coming out of abuse, coming out of rebellion, coming out of sadness or midlife crisis. I just don't have those kind of big events. I haven't sailed an ocean or won an award for bravery. I've lived a fairly predictable, safe life in lots of ways. But I do feel I have a story. Actually, you know, I haven't smoked drugs or anything. I haven't done weed. Once after a knee surgery, I had morphine or something in my body, and I was higher than a kite. That's my only experience with drugs. And when that drug was going through my body and I woke up in the surgery, in the recovery room, I was singing, I was floating on a cloud, I grabbed a clipboard, the nurse came over and said, shh, Mr. Lang, shh, it's all right. And I just felt wonderful. It's easy to see why someone would use a drug like that all the time if they were in constant pain, if they were in despair, if there was hurt and loneliness and abuse and separation and no community. It's easy to see why someone would want to use something to make you feel so wonderful. I'm thankful to have been protected as a child by a safe home, by loving parents. And I don't feel shortchanged or unworthy because I haven't had a life filled with strife, conflict, and recovery. I also know that today or tomorrow, life can change in an instant. And we can be shattered. We can be driven to a point where we've never been in our life. So I'm aware of that, and I'm thankful for every day. I think, though, that I'm just like you. We're here today, all of us, doing the best we can with what we have, searching for meaning, needing to be loved, and wanting somehow to help out. You and I have a story worth telling. No matter how unimportant or uneventful we think it is, and I believe that it's a telling of our stories and sharing it with other people carries insight and healing for ourselves and encouragement to others. Our stories define us. They predict us. They define how we'll act in a situation. They become a legacy for another generation, for our children and our family and our friends. And if you and I can connect our stories, understand our stories, the events of our childhood and adolescence, make sense of how these things have shaped us and our view of the world, we're more likely to be adults who can be compassionate, who can be understanding, who can reach out to the world and care for the world. We're more likely to be salt and light in a community that longs for healing. And understanding our story means recognizing lies that we've been told in our childhood and in our adolescence. It means holding on to truths that we've been taught, holding dearly to things that we've been taught. It means forgiving those who've hurt us and letting go of bitterness, disappointment, regrets, and then living with a heart that is soft and receptive and compassionate. This is how I believe Jesus would have us live. My story then is intertwined with people throughout my life that had a big impact on me, that somehow shaped my view of the world, shaped my thinking. Richard Wagamese is an Aboriginal author, Canadian author. He posted on his Facebook one day a quote from Albert Einstein that says, "You can't fix what's in your head with what's in your head. You need other people for that. You need their ears, their hearts, and their spirits. You need words plumbed into the very core of your being, pushed out into the air and given meaning by being shared with someone else." A friend of mine who I've been working with for 5 years, coming out of depression and a suicide attempt, realized after despair, after darkness, that his path to strength and healing was shared by those in his life who would walk along with him right now, supporting him and encouraging him. He knew he couldn't become strong after this dark time on his own. You and I are hardwired for connection. We're hardwired for attachment and community, and this is why we're here today. This is why we need each other. This is why we need House Church to be together. I was able to receive the gifts of these people in my life with ears to hear because my parents loved me well. Jesus talked a lot about farming. And he said, now listen to the parable of the sower. When a man hears the message of the kingdom and does not grasp it, the evil one comes and snatches away what was sown in his heart. This is like the seed thrown by the roadside. And the seeds thrown on stony patches represents a man who hears the message and he eagerly accepts it. But it has not taken root in him and does not long last. The moment trouble or persecution arises through the message, he gives up his faith at once. The seed sown among the thorns represents the man who hears the message and then worries if his life and the illusions of wealth choke it to death, and so it produces no crop in his life. But the seed sown on good soil is the man who hears and understands the message. His life shows a good crop, 160, 30 times what was sown. I'm thankful that, for the most part, I've been good soil, that the message has come and I've had the opportunity to listen. It's because of my parents and what they gave to me in my early years that this happened. I'm thankful to have been brought up in a Christian home. Mom and Dad were good people. Dad was a chartered accountant, and he was a gentleman who overcame polio to be a golfer, a gardener, and a dad to play catch with, even though he had no muscles in his upper arm, no muscles in his shoulder, no muscles in his right calf, and his quadriceps were compromised. Dad taught me to fish and play golf, and he watched my football games on Sunday when some in the church thought that playing football on Sunday was wrong. Many nights I fell asleep listening to Dad play the piano downstairs. He played everything by ear, seldom using a sheet of music. Mom was like many women of her generation. She was a housewife. She managed the affairs of a three-child home with patience and love. She stood by the window every day when I went off to school, and she blew me a kiss right up until grade 12. I walked down the lane, and that was the last thing I saw every day. She was able to dance in the kitchen with our little Cocker Spaniel Mitzi when we came home from church on Sunday. She rocked me to sleep as a child, singing songs and providing safety and security I needed. To be honest, Mom and I had some tough times when I became a teenager. And I actually finally figured out that I was right about everything when I was about 16. And so I came into conflict with this woman who didn't know anything. I know you can't relate to that at all as parents, but Mom frustrated me terribly. And being a 16-year-old and a 15-year-old, I was disrespectful. In return, I didn't know how to deal with it, so I was malicious sometimes. To her credit, though, we seldom ever finished a day without reconnecting, without letting go of the conflict. So I was able to cope with the mess that is adolescence because I knew that Mom and Dad had my back. They loved me when I was stupid or disrespectful, and they wanted the best for me. I knew they would look out for me and look after me. Later in my teaching and counseling career, I've been studying attachment theory and an explanation of how we develop in a healthy way. And as I've reflected on my years, as I've been trying to prepare for this and think about my story, I'm thankful that this theory integrates with what I understand about myself, that I had a healthy attachment. I was grateful for attachment. I felt secure and safe. Attachment talks about three developmental phases, three things that are supposed to happen when you're well-loved and when you're secure. And to become mature adults, to become mature young adults, there's emergence, which is feeling safe to move away from the home, feeling safe to venture out, knowing that home base is secure. There's curiosity and natural curiosity. There's adaptation, and we learn that very young when Mom and Dad says, no, you can't have the cookie. I'm sorry, you've got to go to bed. And I'm sorry you're upset, but you can't have the cookie. We learn to adapt. We learn that futility is a way of changing, of turning direction. And finally, integration. We learn that things are not black and white. We learn that there's mixed feelings and that mixed feelings are healthy. If we feel strongly one way without considering the alternative, it's a sign of immaturity. And today in our world, Tim's talking about extremism in Iraq and Syria and people slaughtering each other all over the world and Republicans and Democrats fighting in the United States. Inability to see someone else's point of view, to tolerate someone else's point of view, to engage it, to consider it, it's a sign of immaturity. Extremism is a sign that you just can't see someone else's point of view. Everybody has to believe what you believe. When children are securely attached to their parents, these three things happen and they result in a healthy young adult. The child in the home feels safe, significant, loved unconditionally, wants to please the parents and wants to be like them. That's a normal thing that happens when you're attached. Children look to their parents as the best answer for their problems, and no matter what goes on outside, the child is safe at home with the parents. This is what defends a child from bullying. The child can be picked on at school, but if he knows mom and dad is home and mom and dad is the answer and mom and dad believes in them 100%, loves them unconditionally, that's a safety for that child, no matter what goes on. The parent takes the lead in a way for the child that's not coercive, controlling, or overbearing. This is my experience at home. When attachment is insecure, there's more likelihood peers will replace the parents. And at a young age, when teenagers cast their parents off and say, I don't want to listen to you, it may be because of an insecure attachment. Parents will lose power and become frustrated. Teens naturally orient to peers and push away a little bit. But in a healthy attachment, there's grace and dignity, and the child remains connected to the adult. And there's potential to carry immature behavior into our adult life. Lack of emergence, lack of adaptation, lack of integration. When we can't adapt, when we get stuck, it's a sign of immaturity. Many of us display immature behavior as adults. Sometimes Pam and I are very immature with each other. Jim took us through a scale at House Church of emotional maturity, and there was a checklist, and there was infant, child, adolescent, and adult. And we did a series of questions and filled this out, and I'm not the only one that scored significantly less than adulthood in terms of my emotional maturity. Pam, of course, was perfect, but I came out adolescent, and maybe even once or twice in my responses to life came out as a child in terms of how I responded emotionally. So a healthy, secure attachment with mom and dad that I had allowed other people to speak into my life from a very young age, from the age that I started to become reflective. Our family attended First Baptist Church in Vancouver. It was a huge inner-city church, very diverse. Mom and dad were engaged in the church, and our home was a place they could bring people to love them, to feed them. I remember Lindsay Gower used to come for dinner a few times a year, and Lindsay had cerebral palsy. He couldn't walk very well. He couldn't walk without a lot of compensating for muscles that he didn't have or muscles that didn't work. He couldn't speak properly. He drooled when he ate. But Lindsay had beautiful shining eyes and a beautiful smile, and he was a gracious man. And what struck me in my formative years from mom and dad was that Lindsay had a dignity about him and a beauty about him that they understood and they recognized and they valued that. Their relationship with him taught me that every person, no matter who they are or what they have done, has an inherent dignity and an inherent worth. They invited people to stay with us for weeks, sometimes months at a time. A recovering alcoholic, a convict. The convict actually was out 18 months for manslaughter. In a rage, he kicked his son, and the son died, and he had to go to jail. He lived with us for over a year. University students, single moms, stayed in our house. And as a teenager, this was huge for me. Always with so many others like Lindsay, Dad displayed grace and kindness, and he took time to talk to those who were tough to talk to. Mom listened. She made meals, and she served her guests. And she had this knack, sometimes a little bit irritating, of getting to real conversation about how people were really doing. She wasn't much for superficial stuff. She probed and challenges, though she embraced, and people loved her for the way she did it. In my teen years, I learned that the underdog, the dispossessed, those who might be disregarded by more socially mobile parents were important. They were lovable. They were worthy. Nonetheless, as a 15-year-old, a 16-year-old, there's a flip side to all this good stuff. Somehow I became burdened with a judgmental spirit. Despite what my parents modeled most of the time, I began to see those outside the church with skepticism, as those who were lost, those who had sinned against God, and at times I maintained a healthy distance from those I figured were non-believers. I've heard from the pulpit, from well-intentioned pastors, that you're either for God or against God. And that meant to me that if you weren't a born-again Christian, you must be against God. I wasn't outspoken in my judgment, but I was cautious, reserved, and often not open to my peers outside the church. I hung out with church kids, and I kept it safe. I stayed by myself a lot at Winston Churchill High School because my church friends went to another school. Being shy and somewhat self-conscious didn't help that either. So with this judgmental spirit, we're having lunch one day at Langara College in the cafeteria, Walter Ng and I. And I was blindsided by a comment that he made to me about my observation of students in the cafeteria. He said, "Peter, you're judging all these people based on symptoms that you see that may mean that they're hurt or unhappy or lost. Why do you feel you can judge these people? Where's that coming from? You really know nothing about them." Walter had enough courage to confront my behavior and call me out. And this was a metaphor or a time in my life when a friend took a risk and change started to happen in my heart. The example of my parents and the courage of Walter to confront my ignorance was God reaching into my life. People were vessels being used to speak to me. Fertile ground. I began to realize that most folks in the church weren't that different from me. They were doing the best they could with what they had. They felt and needed to be loved. They worked hard. They kept doors open for people. They sacrificed themselves for their kids. If grace was undeserved and had nothing to do with my efforts, why did I feel that I was in and they were out? Why did I see myself as more worthy of God's love and acceptance than the next guy? Did God really hold contempt and judgment for those people because they were sinners? Or did he love them? In a Christian home, twice on Sunday church attendance made me no better in God's eyes than the students in the cafeteria. God's grace is not selective. Jesus died for the world, not just for some of us, not just for those of us born in a Christian country or fortunate enough to have heard the gospel. So I felt conflicted growing up in a church, 16, 17 years old. I thought being an evangelical Christian meant you look for opportunity to share the gospel with anyone and everyone who could be lost. Could be your best friend, could be your brother, the guy on the bus you see every day. People talked about souls saved, leading people to Christ and lives transformed. Our church even had programs that sent teams out to the West End to ask people what would happen if they died tonight. It was called the Coral Ridge Program. Would they spend forever in eternity with Jesus? And if you got a foot in the door, you could have the little Four Spiritual Laws booklet to frame your discussion, have a prayer, and the angels would rejoice in heaven. They went to the beach, and 40 years later, Pam and I, when we sometimes go to the beach, we still say we're going to the beach to preach and teach and see who we can reach. And we giggle together and think that's funny. But that was the joke back in the day, was this is what we did, and this is how we coped with this difficulty of feeling like we needed to go out and draw people in and hammer them over the head. I questioned the religious culture I was immersed in. The explosion of the Jesus People movement in the 70s also drew me away from a traditional approach to my faith and childhood Sunday school experience. There was a new freedom and joy that appealed to those of us, many of us in the mainstream churches. And the hippie movement didn't help at all either. Long hair, frayed jeans, patches all over the jeans, nonconformity. That affected me in subtle but lasting ways. Nobody I knew, even the elders of the church, were winning souls on a regular basis. Didn't make sense, but I felt guilty. To be gracious, also modeled to me by my parents and mentors, meant you didn't hit people over the head with your point of view. To be gentle meant you weren't aggressively forcing conversations about heaven and hell. And yet I felt sometimes that I needed to. To follow Jesus' simple teaching that I shouldn't judge others meant that my relationships were not about me driving the agenda, me pushing forward my point of view. They were about loving people. It's two very, very different things. It's occurred to me recently as I work out my faith that you or I would probably no more likely sit down with a Muslim or a Jew or a Jehovah's Witness and listen and embrace what they had to say to us and let them try and convince us of their faith than we would fly to the moon or swim in the Ganges River. We just wouldn't do it. We would want to protect our point of view. We wouldn't want people telling us how to live. Why did I expect that people would listen to me explain something and be coercive if I wasn't invited, if they didn't want me to share my story? What did make sense to me in my early 20s was that I was expected to be salt and light in places where there was rot and darkness. I was lucky enough to hear at First Baptist Church John Stott. He was a famous English theologian. He came to speak at the church, and the church was packed. The only thing I remember from his talk, as powerful as it was, as profound as it was this metaphor that Jesus used of salt and light. If society was failing, if there was no compassion, if there was no liberation, if society wasn't fair or moral, it was because those who knew Jesus were not engaged. Those who knew Jesus were not acting in the world. And even though I was surrounded with Christian peers and immersed in Christian ministries, I felt detached from many of the ideas and doctrines that others, often older generations, seemed to accept. I didn't give in to the pressure. One night I came home from a coffee house that I was working at, and my mom and dad had a Bible study, and they were in the charismatic movement, and it was a wonderful time for them. And their friends, Bill and Winnipeg, were there at the end. And I walked in, a 17-year-old, and Bill threw a cushion down on the floor and said, "Sit down, Peter, it's time." And I knew what he wanted. I knew he wanted me to sit down, and they would lay hands on me and pray for me, and the Holy Spirit would come into me, and I would speak in tongues. As a teenager with a strong sense of independence, I wasn't about to conform to that, and I said, "No, thank you." I knew that somebody else couldn't dictate to me how Jesus was going to move in my life. I also rejected my mom's sense that appearances were everything and that you had to give this certain impression to the neighborhood and the community and that anything that you could do that would be misconstrued as wrong, you just don't do. And that was a tough thing for me to swallow in my upbringing. And I knew that while prayer was important, God wasn't connected to my little hotline to heaven answering my prayers so that life would be smoother or easier. And when a person's life was full of pain or trials or stress, it wasn't because of traditional church doctrine that I'd heard that God must really love you because he's testing you so much. All things didn't work together for good according to some plan God had. If it included suffering, despair, genocide, starvation, disease, and death. God does, however, work in all of these situations through you and I. So my sense of faith and God might have been a reason why I'm not shocked and disillusioned when bad things happen to good people. Most of my mom's best friends died of cancer. Dad had much of his physical strength taken away from polio when he was 23 years old, young and powerful and athletic. Seniors' homes that I was in were full of seniors, withering, tired people who were once dynamic, hardworking people. Pam and I were young parents living in Squamish. She was a teacher. She was a nurse. I was a teacher. And there was a phone call on a Sunday evening. It was my brother-in-law, John, from Arrington. And with tears in his voice, he told me that his son, his youngest son, Sean, had just been electrocuted in a bathtub. There was an electrical problem, they found out later, with the furnace wiring underneath this old house, and the wire was touching the copper tubing, and the current ran through the tubing while Sean was in the bathtub holding onto the faucet, and that was it. He was 18 months old. The unthinkable had happened, the loss of a child, something every parent holds just at arm's length. We just can't even entertain the idea. I had only been with Sean a few times in his young life, so I didn't have a bond with him. My sadness was for Sean, but it was more about the grief of my sister and her family. Pam and I knew the right thing to do at that time was to get to my sister as quickly as possible and just be there in the midst of grief and despair. Jesus went with Pam and I to Arrington that night. Simply to weep, to love, to listen, and be in that place. My tears were for my sister as I hugged her and she wept in my arms. This was where Jesus would be. This is what Jesus was acquainted with. Some people in church around Mary Ellen suggested God makes no mistakes, or that Sean must have been special for God to take him so early. Even that God was saving Sean from a rough life, or that God was punishing Mary Ellen. But we knew Jesus wept. He wept with Mary Ellen and John and Aaron and Isaac. And that he doesn't want to take babies away from their parents for some reason. There was no explanation or spin we could put on this event that would ease the pain or soothe the grief. While religious people meant well, their words were no solace to my sister. A guy I listen to a lot, Bruce Coburn, is a Canadian songwriter. One of his lyrics that we've sung in church on Christmas Eve, "It's not to the palace that the Christ child comes, but to hookers and shepherds, street people and bums, and the bereaved and the dispossessed." Jesus comes to the bereaved and to the hopeless and to all of us when we're on our knees in tears. This is why Mary Ellen carries on. This is how she copes with a grief that she will never be completely free of. Mom and Dad modeled a life oriented around others through hospitality, graciousness, and engaging people on a deeper level. Walter, my friend at Langara College. Oh, sweetheart. Poor baby. Walter challenged my judgmental spirit and challenged me to look past overt behavior or visual cues to the heart of a person. I'm grateful to many others like Len Zawadzki, pastor at the Trinity Baptist Coffee House. He hosted Bible studies and spoke into our lives every Tuesday night. John McClaverty, Roy Bell, Gord Patterson were pastors at First Baptist Church when I was young. I was about 16, and I developed a relationship with those men that so speaks to this power of attachment that I'm talking about. They were bright, witty, compassionate men who encouraged questioning, thinking outside the box, and they wouldn't fit into people's expectation that they should somehow be pious, somber, godly men who didn't have a beer every now and then or behave like the rest of us. I looked up to them. I wanted to be like them. I wanted to follow their lead. I wanted to help them out, and they made me feel significant. Roy Bell, the head pastor at First Baptist Church, wrote a reference letter for me when I went to become a teacher. I was applying for jobs. And just simple words that he said on that letter gave me so much strength, encouraged me so much that somebody else believed in me. This is the power of being mentored. I think Darcy, some point in the fall, might be talking a little bit about mentorship and discipleship and how important this is for our youth and for each other. It's one of the most powerful influences in a person's life. And every parent can be a mentor. Teachers, coaches, bosses, sponsors for apprentices, grandmas, grandpas, anyone can make a difference that allows a young person to feel significant, independent, courageous, competent, and generous. We need each other in our lives to become our true selves. This is how God has created us to be. Outside of healthy relationships, we are outside of who and what we're meant to be. It is ironic, though, that we are hardwired by the Creator with a part in our being that will not be fulfilled by human relationships. And that's kind of the flip side of our need for each other, is we will always let each other down. There will be a time when the only solution, the only answer, the only true north is Jesus in our heart and a connection with him, a relationship with him. For me, here for a very short time in eternity, this connection to my Creator at the core of my being, it's the lifeblood of who I am. And Jesus used all these people in my life in my developmental years to draw me to him. My adult life and career since these developmental experiences have been shaped by what I learned as a child, a teen and a young adult. It's no surprise that Pam and I ended up being a teacher and a nurse. We've both given freely of our time and hearts to those we've served professionally, to our community, and to our kids. At House Church, a couple months ago, Jim asked us how we experience God in our lives. And the common response had to do with what came naturally for us, what we love to do. For me, working with kids, leading, encouraging, some might even say talking a lot, came naturally. It felt right to be doing what I did. I love coaching many sports, for in that role, the ability to mentor, teach, and encourage in the context of a game was a beautiful mix, and it was a privilege. And if it sounds like character development slowed or stopped when we fell into adult roles, nothing could be further from the truth. And together, you and I, over the last few months, have been focusing on emotional health and growth. We've been challenged, we've been probed, we've been pushed out of our comfort zone to consider where God wants to continue his work in us, each one of us, even those of us in our graying years. Part of that process has been going back to go forward. For some of us, going back might mean confronting lies or examples of adults who cared for us, beliefs formed about who we are, how we respond to conflict, or how to respond to negative emotions in ourselves and others. Sometimes we allow shame or guilt or anger or defendedness to take us away from who God wants us to be. Kids I work with sometimes, kids at the alternate school, they have this sense that the mess of their family, their parents' lives, their current condition is somehow their fault. That if they'd been better or done something better, this wouldn't have happened. Through the constant buzz that is conflict and dissent, disappointment, feeling negated as a person, these kids will become adults. And they will either confront the forces and the lives that have hurt them, that have oppressed them, and be free of them, or they will continue the cycle that has happened to them. They will continue to be like their parents. If you and I don't make sense of our childhood and our parenting and how we were parented, we will not be healthy parents. This generational element of families, the cycle of hurt and despair, has been so evident in kids I work with and families I work with and folks that you know in the Aboriginal community. The aftermath of residential schools, cultural genocide, was the goal of our government. First Nations people are still reeling from the effects. The same man, young man that I'm working with, had a chat with his father recently about residential school. His father had no idea how to be a father, no idea how to be an emotionally open person because of the hurt and abuse that came down to him through this awful, dark time in our history where we oppressed our Aboriginal people. When we move into adulthood out of the brokenness of child without coming to terms with and healing from this brokenness, we pass this on to our children, and the cycle continues. Many people I work with who come into school wanting to have help with their kids don't know where to go. They've lost power. They don't know what to do. They blame the kid. I got a bad kid. This kid needs more punishment. I need to take more stuff away. If I've tried taking the computer away, it doesn't work. I've tried grounding him. It doesn't work. The problem is not the kid. The problem is not you've got a bad kid. It's a relationship problem. And if it's a relationship problem with a 13-year-old, guess who is responsible for figuring it out? Not the 13-year-old. It's up to us to figure out how to be a parent, how to be caring, how to be judicious, how to be compassionate, how to set boundaries. It's our responsibility. And if we haven't figured this stuff out, we won't be able to do that well. I believe freedom from our past involves the work of the Holy Spirit. And it usually happens in community with others. It happens in house church. It happens in here. It happens on walks with your friends. To be known by others, to be understood, to be listened to and cared for is the work of the Holy Spirit. This is why we need each other. It is ironic that those most hurt and wounded by unhealthy attachments as children are those most likely to protect their hearts. They're those who are most likely not to let people in. The pain of being hurt or not having our needs for love and affection does not go away easily. If we don't open ourselves to others, there's potential to be misunderstood or worse. For me, being open to change and personal growth means learning from everything that comes at me in life. That's why Paul said everything works together for good. I think this is what he meant. God can teach us through anything that happens, refine us, strengthen us, humble us, and empower us. Being fertile soil means looking beyond church culture. It means looking beyond church literature or Christian literature. It means reading novels, looking at movies, reading the newspaper, embracing the world around us, making sense of it in the context of our connection to God, in the context of our faith. I learn from people who don't profess faith. I learn from being alone in the forest and embracing solitude. A few examples of learning in my life right now. As a teacher, I was at a conference, and a Sioux Indian from South Dakota, Dr. Martin Brokenleg, is a world-known speaker and a Christian man, talked about a new idea for wholeness, a new idea for development for children, and offered us an alternative to how we do things. And he tells the story of a mom in a mall with her son. And the mom is obviously at wit's end. The son is crying and dragging his feet and resisting. And the mom is pulling the little boy. And there's just this huge tension going on between these two. And the mother turns to the little boy and berates him and scolds him, maybe swats him on the bum and, you know, and is really, really firm with him, but really aggressive with him. And a simple question, why did she feel like she could talk to a child in a way that she wouldn't talk to an adult? Imagine if you or I were in conflict and something wasn't going the way you wanted at work or at home with your partner. And you started speaking to your colleague or your partner like that, or your friend. Look here, you stupid jerk. I'm going to let you have it in about 1 minute if you don't stop your pathetic sniveling. Stop your whining right now. We would never talk that way to each other. We would never berate each other. And this spoke to me. As a father, I was less than perfect. Graham came home one day, grade 9, math test result. Like 9 out of 42. I was tired and grumpy. Graham was in his bedroom. I went downstairs with the paper, and I unloaded both barrels, pointing at him, probably spit shooting out my mouth. This is not good enough. This is not acceptable. You cannot do this, blah, blah, blah. And I just lost it. Just ridiculous. Graham left. He bolted out the door, ran out, black of night. And as my adrenaline calmed down and my rage calmed down, I just had this overwhelming sense of stupidity, of what have I done? And I jumped in the car and I went out and looked for Graham. And he was over in Glacier View. And I picked him up and said, come on, buddy, get in the car. And we sat together in the carport shoulder to shoulder while I backtracked and realized that my immaturity, my unresolved anger, my unmet expectations got the better of me, and I had hurt the spirit of this young boy, and I had been abusive and overly corrective to him. And I've apologized to Graham many times since, but I had to say to him that night, I just messed up big time. I had no right to say that. This 9 out of 42 is not a big deal. It's nothing. It doesn't matter. We'll get through it. That's what we do as adults. We lose it. We go to immaturity. We lose our centeredness. Two simple questions for me growing up. Why did I feel like I could judge people? And how I treated children, how I treated my students, how I treated young adults. They were gifts from God to me that spoke to my heart and changed who I am as a person. And I've been attending Gordon Neufeld seminars and studying his material on attachment theory. It's affected me as a counselor, this idea of connectedness and the power of attachment. Reading Richard Wagamese's novels, books like Ragged Company about four homeless people in a blizzard, probably in Winnipeg, have impacted me, have helped to create this view I have of life and how I see other people. Christian authors like Philip Yancey, Donald Miller, Rob Bell, they planted seeds in my heart. They've encouraged me. They've given me new ideas. Being part of this church has planted seeds in my heart, and I've grown from it. And as I was thinking about that and thinking about the River Church, then I was thinking about Pam and I in Squamish. Over the 35 years that we've been here, we always were in a house church. It's kind of ironic. We were members of a larger church, but we always met together on a Tuesday or Wednesday night and studied Scripture together. But it wasn't just studying Scripture. It was discussion and debate and coffee and laughter. There were folks, Frank and Nadine Bauman, Ellen Maxine Siemens, John and Arlene Perdue, Steve and Cindy Wozluski, George and Iris Kelly, Ben and Helen Dennis, Jack and Shirley Purdy. They had rich, rich times together. And that was our community. That was our house church. Seeds planted in our hearts, continuing to grow. So, I'm retired. I've gone from working in a building like this with 400 to 600 people, constant buzz, being somebody, going to meetings, speaking in front of kids, speaking in front of assemblies, being somebody, to walking the dog. And it's a huge transition. Not having meetings to go to, not having people look to you for answers, not having to interact with all these people, a huge transition for me. It's been a humbling experience. But it's a time of life I'm embracing and loving. The constant buzz and activity of parenting, teaching, coaching, and community life has been replaced with walks on the field that used to be a golf course behind our house. Or we go down to the ocean and throw sticks in the water, and Farley gets the stick and brings it back, and we do it all again. We go to Steve's coffee shop. I read the paper at breakfast, do a Sudoku. And I work on photography, my high school hobby that has stuck with me for life. And I've realized that at this time in my life, we all have phases in our life. We all have times where there's certain needs. This is a good time. It's a time to embrace. It's a time of slowing down and reflecting. It's a time of not being on, not having to produce for somebody all the time. But I continue in this state to learn, continue to embrace materials like attachment theory. I continue to reflect and being drawn to the grace of God. I do a bit of counseling at the alternate school, and it's a privilege to walk alongside kids as they cope with overwhelming circumstances. And no doubt you've heard about our house church being involved with the alternate school, and it's pretty cool. It's a beautiful example of this idea of salt and light, this idea of being Jesus in the community. We make muffins. I don't make muffins, but muffins are made, and meals are served, and we met down there as a house church and planted plants, perennials, and I don't even know what perennials are. Planted these year-long plants and seasonal plants and decorated the flower boxes at the front of the school. And it's really neat because that kind of involvement has made an impact on those folks. Mark, who's a teacher at the alternate school, said on the final day when I dropped off the gift packages that our house church had made up, he said, "I love the River Church. I love the River Church." This is a guy who doesn't go to church, not interested in church, but he sees Jesus reaching out and being salt and light. and from this dog, this ridiculous dog. There he is. I learn all kinds of things. We're walking from the street to our house one day. It's a townhouse. And I've got Farley on the lead. And a fella comes walking in from a different direction. And Farley sees this man from a distance. He starts to dance and wag his tail back and forth. His back end is going crazy. And I have no alternative but to this dog drag me over to this gentleman on this lead. The guy could have been a drug dealer. He could have been just a nasty person. He could have been completely disinterested. But Farley had unconditional positive regard for this man. He was happy to see him. He didn't judge him. He didn't evaluate him and said, can't get next to that person because of this. And it reminded me of the potential to treat everyone I meet with worthy of respect, someone who had dignity, someone with a story just like you and I, someone I could acknowledge with a friendly smile, or I could pass by without a glance. Farley also reminds me of the need to play, the need to do what feels right. And for Farley, he is in the zone when he's chasing a stick at the ocean. He is never more animated, more excited, more full of adrenaline and optimism than when I'm holding the stick and about to throw it into the ocean. This is what gives him life. This is what is life breath for him. And you and I are created like that. We're created to have something that we do that is God-given, that makes us feel good. Our brain chemistry is so altered when we play, when we laugh, when we dance, when we sing, and when we have fun together. All those positive chemicals that God has designed in our brain to give us a feeling of well-being. We need to play. Farley reminds me of the need to play. And finally, from this dog, this sense of attachment. Attachment means you want proximity. You want to be close to. You want to be in the presence of the person you're attached to. And it's this proximity that gives us meaning and a sense of safety and comfort. He loves nothing more than to sit down. Well, it's not true, but he loves to sit down with me at coffee in the morning. And eventually he leans his back against me, and I'm leaning against a Chesterfield, and I'm on the floor with my coffee, and we're just hanging out together. And it's just this proximity to Farley, this attachment to him, that reminds me how much we need each other. We need to have this connection to each other. We need to sit, as Darcy talks about, knee to knee and say, how was your day? How are things going? That's what we were designed to do. That's how we're made. When I was about 20 and involved in the church coffee house ministry, a bunch of us went on a retreat at Cultus Lake. I had to play guitar. I actually had to speak in church that Sunday night. I was about 20, 21. I had to play guitar for the sing song first and then speak. And there we were at Cultus Lake on a retreat. It was a Saturday night. It was cold and rainy, dark, dark, dark. And after a session with the leader in the big room, we were encouraged to go and be quiet together, be quiet alone, seek solitude, be quiet, shut everything out, have no distraction. And I chose to go outside the room, and on the deck there was a veranda all around this big room. And it was black as could be. And the rain was running off the gutters down onto the deck. And I sat inside the safety of the awning there. And I just said a simple question. I said, God, if you exist, and as a church kid who's been in ministry for a long time, could you somehow show me? I want to know you. I want to feel your presence. And I want to be your guy. And what happened was, I think, what Bill Pegg wanted for me the night that he wanted me to sit down and be prayed for. And it's tough to describe unless I say how I felt. I was completely overwhelmed with the Holy Spirit, with the presence of God. And it was a physical sense of God almost reaching from this black of night into my life, into my heart. And I'll never forget it. There was no remorse, no shame, no regret, no sense of inadequacy, no fear, just in that moment, the sense of intimacy with the Creator, with Jesus, in a way that I'd never felt before. I'm grateful for that. And you can't explain this stuff from a science perspective. You can't argue it with university people or atheists. You can't prove its validity or argue its truth. You can only know what you felt and accept it, but you can't fully understand it. I do know this. I know this for a truth. God is all love. God is gentle. God is infinitely powerful and astoundingly gentle. He's always near, no matter what befalls us. And this is my truth. I lay in bed last night with my heart pounding. I became aware that my heart was just going boom, 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 boom. I thought, wow, where's that coming from? And I knew that I was anticipating being here with you this morning. And I thought, boy, I hope I get some sleep tonight. And I just had to relax and breathe in and breathe out. Perfect love casts out all fear. My burden is light and my yoke is easy. Anyone who comes to me, I will in no ways cast out. And those truths that I've held on to from my childhood allowed me last night to just settle, allowed my heart rate to come down, and allowed me to have a good sleep. And I did have a good sleep last night. As a young adult, Roy Bell at First Baptist would often end his sermons when everybody was quiet and intimate and receptive. And he quoted an Alfred Tennyson poem. And there's a line that says, closer than breathing. And Roy would hold out his hands and he'd go, nearer than hands and feet. Closer than breathing and nearer than hands and feet. Jesus is to you. And we don't recognize it a lot of the time. We're too busy. We're too confused. We're too chaotic. But if we slow and quiet and listen and have hearts that are open, not defended, God's Spirit will speak to you and I. This is the mystery of my faith. It's the mystery of our faith. I was watching communion this morning, the mystery of communion. If an average person came in off the street and saw people standing around with little bits of bread, dunking it in a glass, and it just makes no sense. This is the beauty of our faith. Jesus, this rabbi, this radical, this man who blew conformity and the norms of the day out of the water with a new commandment, love one another, be together, be in community. Nearer than breathing, closer than hands and feet. Thanks for listening. It's been a privilege to share with you. I hope that there's something that you can grab onto, something that's maybe encouraged you, something about my story that, if nothing else, helps you understand who I am a little bit more, something that might affect your role as a parent or your role as a partner in your relationship. But I do thank you. Thank you for being patient and listening. Even the little ones, you guys did amazing. Thank you, Darcy.